I'm going to talk about electronic excited states of elements in solids, and I'm going to present work made by myself and Solid Lab Barandiaran. Both of us want to congratulate Ramon in this special occasion, and also want to thank the organizers for this opportunity. My goals in this presentation are first to call attention into this issue, second to present, to give an overview of the few results that we have been able to get in the last years, and third to discuss or to comment on the challenges that they pose. Why are they interesting? Well, they are involved in a lot of technological applications, and I will not list them, but I will only mention two things. The US Department of Energy, in particular the Office of Science, established 10 areas where they wanted to know the basic research needs, all of them related to energy, of course. And in two of them, the central thing are just the elements, the F elements, and the excited elements, the excited states of them. They are also involved in the others, but I will only mention these two. In the case of actinides, involved in advanced nuclear energy systems, the scientific grand challenges established were summarized in resolving the F electron challenge to master the chemistry and physics of actinides and actinide-bearing materials. In the case of lanthanides involved in solid-state lighting, the challenges were moving from serendipitous discovery towards rational design of the devices for solid-state lighting, and also establishing the microscopic pathways through which energy losses occur as electrons produce light. And these are related to the excited states of filaments too. So from now on, I will only talk about solid-state lighting. And in this figure taken from Sandia National Lab, we can see that incandescent lamps only convert 5% of the energy we provide into light, while fluorescence lamps can convert up to 25%, and solid-state lighting devices, when they appear, already cross the line of 25%, and probably they will go well above that. So we have promises and challenges associated to that. So what is the promise in solid-state lighting is that we could have devices with very low energy consumption and very long life, up to the point that they are expected to substitute conventional illumination in the USA at 2025. The challenges for that are many, and I will focus on two, which are finding phosphors, which are efficient converting energy, and which you can control the color, because if you have light for illumination, you don't want it to be too blue, for instance. You want it to be warm, like this one here. In the case of fluorescence lamps, the challenge is to produce mercury-free and so environmentally friendly fluorescence lamps. That means that you have to produce the discharge by something else, for instance with xenon, and then also to have them being highly energy efficient. If you produce a discharge with xenon, you excite in the ultraviolet, so you don't want to produce ultraviolet light, so you need to cut your photon in two, so you need two emissions in the visible, and that is done by what they call quantum cutters. So the challenge is finding phosphors which are good quantum cutters. I will show two examples of the first of the phosphor, which is used in solid-state lighting devices, commercial ones. These are cerium doped yttrium aluminum garnet. The way it works is that you produce light very efficiently with LED, but this is blue and you cannot use it for illumination, so you cover your device with a layer of this phosphor. And what happens is that the phosphor absorbs the blue and now converts it to yellow. Part of the blue goes through the phosphor and finally they mix outside, and the blue and the yellow give you white light that you can use for illumination. So the blue absorption, this is the spectrum, and the yellow emission, which is this one, the experimental spectrum, they correspond to transitions between 4F1 and 5D1, states of the 4F1 and 5D1 configurations. All of them excited states except for this one. In the case of the quantum cutter, one example that has been produced is gadolinium 3+ doping this fluoride. It has been excited above that, then it decays here, and then there is this one emission, visible emission, then goes down, and then another visible emission. These are states of the configuration 4F7. So what is the first principle point of view? Or at least one first principle point of view? Well, most of the times, these materials create effects. These F elements create effects. And the effects may be simple, like uranium substituting for a zirconium in a high symmetry site, or cerium for lithium in the material I just mentioned in a low symmetry site, or even having double substitutions, like in this material where you have neodymium and cerium substituting for yttrium, but at the same time yttrium and aluminium interchanging each other. So you may end up with a very complex three-dimensional complexes effects. And all this demands accurate and efficient embedded cluster methods, and or large embedded clusters, or large or very large supercells. On top of that, they are heavy elements, both lanthanides and actinides, and that means that relativistic effects, and in particular the spin orbit, can be very important. This is the calculation of the energy surfaces of ytterbium in this bromide without the spin orbit and with a spin orbit. So you can see that the splitting, you cannot do anything if you don't do it. So you need relativistic Hamiltonians with the spin orbit coupling. Then you have open cells and a lot of quasi-degeneracies. So for instance, in the ytterbium, in this chloride here, the same diagram as before at the Cassie-CF level, you get the 4F, for the ground state belongs to the 4F14 configuration, but you have excited states where you jump one electron from the 4F to the 5D, either EG and T2G, or to the 6S, or even to an impurity trap exciton. So all these states are, let's say, quasi-degenerate, and you have many. In addition, you have to represent active electrons which are inner and outer, and explain this with samarium, which is, there is nothing special about samarium. And here you have the radial functions, and the 5s and 5p cells, which are closed cells, and they are the main responsible for bonding here. They look like this, but you have open cell inside, not outside, inside, especially inside the closed cell. So this is the 4F open cell. And when you jump one electron from here to the 5D or to the 6S, you have open cells inside, outside the closed cell here. So you need, because of this and because of the quasi-degeneracies, you need to handle a static correlation, for instance, with a multi-determinant mean field approach like state average KCCF, and also dynamic correlation with a multi-configurational balance, meaning that it should be good for all the types of configurations that are involved here. And finally, you need to use large basis set. And just the last thing, they create crowded manifold of excited states. So in this case of uranium substituting for zirconium, we have a manifold which is the 5F2, looks like this. It's quite crowded, but on top of that you have the 5F161, which is, this is the only the lowest part. We have a yellow here which belongs to this configuration. So in general we have crowded manifolds. This case I'm showing here corresponds in this diagram where we are showing the 4FN levels calculated with crystal field theory. These are not experimental, these are experimental. Of the lanthanide trivalent lanthanides, and the ones I showed before corresponds to this column here. So we have all these possibilities. These are the ones of gadolinium, which was the quantum cutter that I mentioned before. So we have crowded manifolds. So we have to handle hundreds or tens of thousands of excited states if we want to do something with all of them, with all the series. So all these characteristics that I mentioned and the demands, I will just summarize the demands. Either we use embedded cluster methods or very large supercells and also clusters. We have to use spin orbit coupling, static correlation, dynamic correlation in a multi-reference scenario, large basis sets, and handling large manifolds of estimates. So now I will show a few applications of doing, which are doable in reasonable time of that we have been able to do in the last years. We have to make, for the demands, we have to make a choice of methods. So our choice, of course, not the only one, but our choice was to use embedded cluster methods. And we use an embedding, which we call a Venetian model potential, which is only useful in ionic host. So this is a large limitation. For the spin orbit coupling, we use spin orbit effective core potentials, in particularly the two component good boring Hamiltonian. And then we use wave functions, not VFT, but wave functions. State average cas SEF for static correlation, multi-state cas PD2 for dynamic correlation. And we have to handle together correlation and spin orbit. So the way we do that is using a two-step spin orbit method. In a first step, we do the cas PD2 calculations with the relativistic but non-spin orbit Hamiltonian. In a second step, we switch on the spin orbit operator, and we transfer all the correlation we gathered before by means of an effective operator, and then finally we use this spin-free state shifter or effective spin orbit Hamiltonian in a small or relatively small CI configuration interaction calculation. Then we use large Gaussian basis sets, and the program, the main program we use for these calculations is the MOLCAS suite of programs, the MOLCAS program. So, what types of studies we have been doing these years? Well, first, local structure of the defects in the ground and in the excited states, like bond length angles and vibrational frequencies. I'm showing here the case of uranium substituting for germanium in this fluoride, energy versus distance. This is the breathing mode. These are the states of the 5F2 configuration, all of them with more or less the same bond length and vibrational frequency. And when you excite one electron to the 6D T2G, what you get is a shrinking of the bond length and again a bunch of states and so on. Of course, since we compute wave functions, we can analyze the nature of the states and the manifolds, analyze the bond, and establish models of interactions. So, for instance, in the material I just mentioned, we can see where the shrinking of the bond length comes when you excite one electron from the 5F to the 6D T2G. So do you have basically one contraction due to ligand field effects, another contraction due to covalency between the uranium 6D and the chlorine, and another contraction due to just transfer from chlorine to uranium 5F. So finally, you get the final contraction of the bond length in the excited state. We computed absorption and emission spectra, transition energies and transition moments, also radiative lifetimes, and finally the absorption and emission profiles, and out of that, Stokes seeds. This is an example of uranium in a fluoride. The calculation of the absorption spectrum profile is here. This is the one of the emission, and the difference between the two maxima corresponds to the Stokes shift, which is very large in this case. Also, radiative lifetime. The reason for this such a large Stokes shift is that the absorption, because of the selection rules, go here, and the emission takes place between different states. So you end up with a lot of contributions to the Stokes shift. And finally, no, not finally, but we also were able to say something about energy transfer mechanisms for instance, upconversion or quantum cutting. In the case of uranium in the chloride, there is a green to blue upconversion. And we propose that the way it goes is that you first get an absorption of a green photon within the 5F2 manifold. After some decay, you get the absorption of a second green photon up to the 5F161 manifold, and after some decay, you just transfer the energy to impurities which are in the same material, because it's impossible to produce this material without these other defects, and they are the ones which finally give you the blue emission. And also a study of high pressure effects on the transition. You can compute with different pressures the energy levels, and out of that compute how the transition energy shifts with the volume contraction, or let's say with pressure. The FF transitions basically do not shift, but the FD transitions may shift either to the red or to the blue. And that depends on the bond length shrinking or enlarging when you excite the electron. And this is related to the shrinking of the bond length that I mentioned before. And as a matter of fact, this is a prediction that was confirmed a few months ago. Okay, we accumulated some experience with this in the excited state of these elements and this host. I think I will skip this. I only mentioned that we can predict blue and red shift semi-quantitatively, and also some relative intensities. Transition energies come with 10% deviations, and vibrational frequencies with around 5%. I will comment now on the cells of cerium, initium, aluminium, garnet. In the diagram that I mentioned before, cerium is in the very left, so we're talking about this column here. So these are the ground state configuration is 4F1. We wanted to know if we were able to say something about to predict, in a way, the blue absorption, the yellow emission, or to reproduce, not to predict. The blue absorption, the yellow emission, red shift, and blue shift, which are induced upon lanthanum co-doping or gallium co-doping, and also to see the role of intrinsic yttrium aluminium, where they change position, anti-side effects on the luminescence of the phosphor. So, trying to go fast, we optimize local structures in the ground and excited states. This is the ground state, distances, bond angles, and so on, but also in the excited states of the 5D1 configuration. Once you have this, you are able to compute profiles of the absorption spectrum, which is the blue absorption. These are to be compared with the experiment, and you can see this belong to the excited states belong to the 5D1 configuration, so we are exciting one electron from here to here, and you can see that the numbers compare reasonably well with experiment. The yellow emission, this is the experiment, is made of seven individual, I mean this is the convolution of seven individual emissions, and so we can compute each of them, 1, 2, 3, up to 7, and finally do the convolution and compare that with experiment. It also compares reasonably well with experiment, but not so well as the absorption, which means that we have a larger problem in the excited state, in the geometry of the excited state, than in the one of the ground state. Redshift upon gadolinium and lanthanum co-doping has been observed. This is an experiment of the wavelength versus the doping with gadolinium, so you can see that there is a shift of the wavelength, it goes to the red. So what we did in this case is just co-dope the material with not only with cerium but also with lanthanum, and you have a bunch of possible situations here. I studied the stability of that, and we did that using DFT. We used that DFT for that purpose. With a cluster it was too large for us to do. So we use DFT. What we found, it's an overall expansion around cerium because of the presence of lanthanum, but this expansion is strongly anisotropic. And when you compare the emission, and this is an absorption, with the material doped with only cerium, which is this number, and with cerium and lanthanum, which is this number, you end up with a red sieve, which is what is detected experimentally. You can make an analysis of the reasons for the redshift on the basis of the energy difference between the centroids of the 4F1 manifold and the 5D1 manifold. And also, this is this energy here. But also the stabilization, the Li-Yang field stabilization of the lowest 5D1 state and the lowest 4F1 state. So this 1, 2, and 3 quantities. And when you do that, you find that the main contribution for the redshift comes from electronic effects that come directly from Lantham. And the effects of the distortions are minor. And the effect of the first cell distortion is really negligible. And these amounts of the this contribution from the lanthanum comes mostly from the ligand field effects and not from the shifting of the centroid. When you go, you do the same with gallium. This is the experimental shift. When you what you find is that you have a blue shift. Why are you interested in blue shifts and in red shifts? Because you want to control the color, the color. So you need to know how things are going to shift when you do, when you code with something else. So we did exactly the same thing, again an overall expansion, exactly as before, and also strongly anisotropic, exactly as before. But now when you do the calculation, what you get is a blue shift between the two numbers. So where does it come from? It comes, you do the same analysis, and this time it doesn't come from the gallium effects. The reason is that gallium is much farther away than before. But it comes from the distortion, the geometrical distortion around cerium, and most of it from the first cell. And about the role of anti-side effects, we have not been able to finish the things, so I just include here, but we couldn't finish. Now, ytterbium in this bromide. Now we move to the end part of the periodic table, of the not the periodic table, but of the series. Ram state is 4F14. This diagram I showed you before. Now we have to play around with these levels that are the ones that we have calculated. We have levels of the 4F14, 5D1, and 6S1 configurations. And you can simulate the whole spectrum, and I don't pay attention to that right now, but just to these levels here that you can detect as possible emitters. In order to find a possible emitter, you have to go there and find a gap down the emitter, which is large enough so as to make the state a candidate to be metastable. So these five emitters are represented here. They are labeled, they correspond to a given configuration, does the symmetry and so on. So these are the calculations. These two have been detected experimentally, and this is the comparison. This one should be in the conduction band of the material, so shouldn't be observable, but we still predict that there should be an emission, possible emission from these two states. And just to finish, the uranium 3+ substituting for yttrium. Now, in this complexity diagram, we are in this column here. The absorption spectrum of this material between 14,000 and 50,000 wave number is represented here. The experimental one is divided in four regions, and now it has been interpreted. But what I want is to tell you the story of the assignment, the interpretation of this diagram. In 1998, it was first published, the first experiment. The region one here was reported, and it was said to be just a very complex, it made of very complex 5F, 6D bands, and there were five electronic origins, five electronic transitions detected but not assigned. These two regions were not reported. This was reported, but no interpretation of that. So in 2003, the first ab initio calculation appeared. It was confirmed that these transitions here correspond to the 5F, 6D, D2G bands, and the five electronic origins were assigned, but we found that many other electronic origins were also present. So we thought that these bands have a multi-origin. And this region here was interpreted as double excitation, 5F, 6D, but also reconfiguration of the 5F cell, so that these are forbidden. And finally, we predicted the DEG1 configuration starting at 42,000 wave numbers. Also, close to that, we published a paper on uranium-4+ doping a chloride, where the 5F, 6D, T2G started at 31,000 wave numbers. So 1 year later, another experiment appeared of the same authors, where two additional electronic origins in this region one here were found, and the seven electronic origins, 5 plus 2, were assigned on the basis of the ab initio calculations. And it was accepted that there were more electronic origins there. For this region here, the interpretation was adopted, and now this region was reported. It wasn't reported before. Now it was reported, and it was interpreted as due to the presence of oxidized uranium 4 plus impurities that were impossible to remove from the sample. And finally, this region was also reported, as well as that, and assigned to the transition that we said before. In 2005, new experimental data, more detail, and the crystal field calculation was done, and two more electronic origins were assigned, so that means a total of 9. And in 2007, we were able to, I don't know if we were able or not, but we did assign 27 electronic origins. I guess that maybe one third of them are not correct, but still it is there. So this is the experiment, and this is the calculation of the crystal field theory that they use to assign 9 electronic origins, which are represented with the arrows here. So these are compared with that, but remember that this is an empirical calculation. So when you do an ab initio calculation, what you do, you compute the energy curves for all the states. Just for simplicity, here I'm representing only without the spin orbit and only the spin quartets. There are lots of doublets, more than quartets. And finally, you end up with 405 spin orbit coupling levels. You tabulate them, you analyze them, and you compute the profiles of the transistors. When you compute the profiles and compare it with experiments, then you may be able to propose the assignment of these levels on the corresponding symmetries. So all the things we have been able to do are summarized in this diagram in the green regions. So I think that the challenge is to go into the middle, and for us at least. My view of the challenges for excited electronic states of FLMs in solids at this point are summarized here. There is one on the atomistic structure optimization, because we have to handle large embedded clusters and supercells, and we have to do it in the ground state and in the excited states. Not only the ground state, also in the excited states. Other one is that we have to face complex open cell systems. Several open cells with many electrons in them. And it has to be done with symmetry restriction. We heard about that this morning. If we lose symmetry, we don't see where the gaps are. Everything mixes with everything. We lose the information. And static and dynamic correlation have to be included, and this has to be done together with a spin orbit coupling. So this morning, this fantastic morning, I would say, because there were a lot of lectures which were incredible. We saw two specifically lectures, one of them talking about methods of embedding, which was in the line of handling this challenge, and also on handling together static and dynamic correlation. We saw more than one. We also handling the crowded manifolds is another challenge. I mentioned before, like 100 to tens of thousands of levels of different nature. And if we are able to do that, then we should be able to go into the final challenge that I mentioned at the beginning, which is study energy transfer mechanisms in some detail. The people involved in the work are presented here and the institutions, and I thank you very much for your attention.
Do you simulate the absorption? Yeah. Do you simulate the profiles? Do you calculate the transition that moment or something like that?
Yeah, you have to compute the transition moments, the oscillator strength, and then you need the vibrational mode which is active. which is usually, we are using the breathing mode all the time. So when you use that with a single mode, you are able to compute a profile that might not be very good, but it's in principle reasonable. And we do that using width packet propagation, which is basically equivalent to computing the Frank Common factors of the variation.
Yeah, it's a very interesting project and useful results. And my question is, did you find any case in which methodologically it is insufficient that you got results which you are not satisfied with? I'm asking because I wonder whether you feel any need in this sort of very advanced analysis of extension of your model, because I understand that you work in two component model, and do you spin other orbit as well, or only one electron?
Only one electron is spin.
And is it always enough?
Well, to say the truth, I would say that I'm not happy with any of the results we produce.
The results are excellent.
No, I wouldn't say so. They have more errors than you like, and especially not me, but the experimentalist. So the experimentalists see this result, and they say, well, usually with crystal field theory, I can do much better than you do, because they feed the experiments to do that. That is true for lanthanides sometimes. It is not true at all for actinides, but they are hard to convince. So in principle, I'm not even happy with this kind of agreement, but it's what you could get. And by the way, the model is not ours. We're using standard programs, and everybody can do that.
Do you plan to extend it for, say, including spin other orbit interaction?
No,
spin or things like that?
I don't think that that's the question at this point, because before that, we have to get much closer to, let's say, to not to the experiments, but to a much better calculation. I don't think that that's an important factor at this point. For instance, handling together dynamic correlation and spin orbit could be more important than that. We have to uncouple them. So we have been able to uncouple, and we have to live with it. So if we have to want to put everything together, we cannot do CASPT2. Then we have to do multi-reference CI. And you cannot do this. You can do it, but in an amount of time that in practice you cannot do it.
Well, let's pass on the microphone to Professor Yang. Please turn it on.
Very nice. I have a question. Do you always want the F orbital very localized to the atom? Or do you ever find it as multi-localized, participating in some with needed or something?
Look, our F orbitals are very localized, but I would say that they are very localized by construction. So I do not have several actinides or lanthanides in the solid so that they could delocalize. They have to be localized.
So it can if your doping level go higher, it may become delocalized?
I don't think in these cases, but for instance, if you think of uranium dioxide, mm-hmm. and you try to study uranium dioxide, we did study uranium dioxide this way, and then when you go up to the D, the F states are quite localized, but when you go to the D states, then they are not at all. So I would say that it depends on the case. When you have an impurity, it's not a problem, the localization. When you have a naturally the localized systems like uranium dioxide, it will be a problem.
One more question. What do you think of TDDRT? Any hope with TDDRT to address the problem?
I don't have any idea. I mean, what we saw this morning is that there are developments that may one think positively that probably sometime it will be possible.
All right, I will allow for one more question for Professor Barth.
I'd rather to make a comment or ask a question. Which is in connection to Professor Kavosky's comment. Isn't it fair to say that today the rather sophisticated facts have been solved to an extent, I mean, just translating your answer, that all the other error sources that we have to solve are by now way more important.
Yeah, I agree absolutely with that. Mm-hmm. I think that the bottleneck is where it was at the beginning of quantum chemistry, which is correlation.
All right. All right.